Tonight we're talking to, well, this afternoon, we're talking to AD. AD is doing a website and a YouTube channel on Magnetic Machines. Is that both?
Yeah, and I've also got another one called We Happy Few, so a couple of YouTube channels, website. We've got the Facebook as well.
Okay, cool. I found you just surfing stuff, and because I'm into tape and tape recording and multi-track, I find that quite interesting. One of your videos popped up. I watched it and I was really interested in what you'd done with one of the cover tracks of the Beatles, I think it was. So tell us how you got into multi-track. Why are you using tape?
Yeah, well, it seems a bit of an odd thing to do at this kind of day and age, being 2025. But I think, like a lot of people, I came from, as a kid, using tape machines. So my school band had a four-track, which we bought together. And this is like the early 90s. So that's how I got into recording in the first instance. Probably used that for a few years. And then around the early 2000s, I kind of moved into digital. And so I got a thing called a Boss BR-8, which is like a mini disc. No, actually, it wasn't mini disc. It was Zip Disc.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is a thing we don't hear very often these days. Went down that road, then eventually got into Macs and kind of got on with that kind of stuff. But after a few years, I just found I wasn't really enjoying it, and the sound didn't kind of, you know, sound like things I like listening to, and the vibe wasn't really what I was going for.
Yeah.
So then I thought, well, actually, I want to try something a bit more organic and go back to the roots of the things I listen to, which then got me back into using tape recorders again.
Mm-hmm.
So this was probably around about 2007, 2008.
Right.
And my first look back into using tape was actually with a reel-to-reel.
Yes.
A thing called a Fostex R8. And it's, I think you've probably seen it yourself, but it's a kind of funny little kind of reel-to-reel recorder and probably the first step on that kind of road.
Yeah.
But it sounded pretty good. You know, it was kind of quite a clean sound and had a nice vibe. So I tried that for a bit. It ended up being broken because a lot of this gear is broken.
Yeah.
And then that got me into using actual cassette recorders and four tracks and eight tracks. So I think I bought a Tascam 688, yep. which is, well, the day, a flagship kind of, you know, big beast of a thing.
Yep.
And started using that with my band.
Yeah, well, my foray into tape, as we spoke about earlier, started with probably a four track TIAC reel to reel. Then we moved on to, I think, an eight track half inch Tascam machine. Ended up with a Fostex 16 track something or other, and then, like you said, you know, tape in the real world then took a bit of a backseat, and digital started to come on, and I started getting into that myself. But I still, a lot of the tape recordings that we did back then still sound pretty good, even though we weren't brilliant producers, but at the time. But the tape element does have a sound to it, which lots of people plugins try to emulate now as well. So what have you been doing? I see you've been recording some covers. Are you recording your own stuff as well? Actually, you did do one of your originals, didn't you, on one of the videos I saw?
Yeah. So a recent one, I've kind of set up this new project, actually. So the Magnetic Machines is relatively new. Mm. I only kind of came up with that actual band name in the summer. I've been doing a few covers, if you like, using the tape machines, doing some classic tracks like the Velvet Underground, one of the Beatles, which is Here Come the Sun, and the Kinks. And I was really trying to find out, you know, what it is I like about those recordings. And a lot of it is the fact they had limited choices. So they had to kind of play the part, get it right, bounce a lot of parts together, which in itself obviously creates a bit of a sound.
Mm.
It's going to be slightly kind of, I suppose, more lo-fi, maybe slightly warmer. And you have to make decisions as well. So it kind of gives you a whole different vibe to when you record on the computer, and you might keep your 25 vocal takes. With this way, you have to kind of limit it and, you know, pick your favourite. So I did several covers and popped on my other YouTube channel, We Happy Few. And they seemed to do pretty well number-wise. So I thought, okay, well, obviously people quite like this. So I guess I learnt from that and then thought I'll try my own kind of song in that kind of same style, which is, I think, the one you probably heard by the Magnetic Machines.
Yeah. It's a nice track, actually, and it sounds really good. And you know, can you tell it's on tape? I don't know, really. It's hard to say, isn't it? But certainly, what did you find the... did you do many overdubs and punch-in, punch-outs? I know when I was recording to tape, I had the foot switch on the go all the time for punch-in, punch-out. It looks like quite seamless on the video, but in reality, was it a lot more complex than that?
Yeah. When I started doing these videos, I started recording the whole thing, but literally my hard drives and phone were kind of full up.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of like just pick bits. Yeah, you have to do it quite a lot. So you have to practice, obviously, way more first and make sure you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And also the big thing is knowing where you want to end up, which I guess you remember as well. Mm. If you want two backing vocals, you've got to think right from the start, well, I'm going to start with the drums and this and whatever else and merge them together,
yeah,
and then leave space later on to kind of merge the vocals later on. So it's all about ordering and working out the sequence of things.
Definitely. Did you find when you were bouncing tracks together, did you do any sort of, I mean, I don't remember there was much option to do much EQ at that point. If you want to stick two or three tracks on one, I don't remember there being much option to do anything with it other than just do the bounce.
I think it depends on your deck, actually. With the thing I'm using, which is a Tascam 246, you've got the individual tracks and the channels where you can actually kind of, you know, balance EQ as well. Mm. So you can do that on the bounce down with this particular machine, but with some of the kind of simpler ones, there's kind of less kind of function to do so.
Yeah.
Or, of course, if you're using a reel-to-reel, then you've got other options depending on your mixer.
Yeah.
So what I tend to do when I'm doing the bounce is I'll kind of cut a lot of the bass out for a lot of things, because otherwise you'll end up alone in mud, won't you,
yes,
you know, by the end of it.
Yeah.
And then it's almost like you have to practice the bounce down as well, because you need to kind of make sure, you know, all the parts are the right kind of level and work together.
Definitely.
We're going to hit it onto tape.
Did you find when you were recording to tape with whatever instrument it was, guitar, bass, you were doing it any differently to when you were recording digital, as in the input signal?
Yeah. I mean, when you're going to tape, you want to get the signal to a noise ratio, you know, pretty high on the signal point. So I'd tend to be hitting it pretty hard on the way in. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you know, the tape hiss is a bit lower. Where if I'm using Logic, I'll definitely kind of keep it much lower down, because obviously you don't want any digital clipping.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, that gives it a bit of a sound as well. So you're kind of driving the preamps a bit harder.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and you're pushing the tape a bit harder, which gives you tape compression as well. So I'll tend not to use that much compression on the way in, because you're almost like doubling up on it otherwise.
Yeah, I think the tape, yeah, it almost gives it a natural compression, doesn't it, when you start driving it a little bit harder. It almost squashes it for you, really, to some degree.
Yeah, exactly.
So how'd you get on with effects? I saw in one of the videos you added, I think, some effects on the way in, maybe, on some of the stuff, maybe the guitar. I think you used a tremolo, but then also things like reverb and that, and you added on the way out. Is that how it went?
It varies from project to project. I mean, again, unless you've got loads of different kind of outboard effects, you have to kind of use them. We can use them once on, you know, each kind of mix, if you like. So therefore, with the guitar, it's a pretty safe bet. Usually, I want a bit of reverb to give a bit of space on the way in, which kind of works quite nicely. But I tend to find if I put too much reverb, like on the vocals, and especially if you're bouncing, it can, again, get a bit muddy and a bit lost.
Yeah.
So I like to kind of save a couple of decisions to the end for that as well.
Yeah.
You know, which I think kind of tends to give you a bit more kind of options to clarify things.
Yeah. And your decision to sort of mix down onto a two-track reel-to-reel, was it? I mean, again, back when I was doing it, we were using DAT recorders then at that point, which were pretty okay, I think. It was kind of a fusion of the tape side of things and then putting it onto a digital format of some fashion, although it was still a tape. I never quite knew how that worked. But
it's a bit weird, wasn't it? Yeah.
But you went for the two-track reel-to-reel, yeah? Any reason for that, as opposed to something like a DAT or...
Well, I've actually on my main channel again, I've done a few kind of different videos kind of exploring different analog options.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you tried this back in the day as well, but one thing that works quite well apart from the reel-to-reel is actually using a VCR, like a video recorder.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't done that, but I know people have, yeah.
Yeah, so I picked up a couple, I don't know, about 2 years ago for about £10 in a charity shop.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as it's a certain type of model, so it needs to be one which you know, a certain brand, it's a hi-fi VCR.
Mm-hmm.
You can get really quite clean analog recordings that way.
Right.
But even so, I found the Revox here, because it's got a couple of different tape speeds, it goes up to 15 inches per second.
Mm.
It kind of adds a bit more warmth, but you keep some of the clarity.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go straight to digital, it doesn't sound bad, but it kind of lacks a bit of warmth. So I think the reason for keeping with the reel-to-reel, it just gives it that extra kind of layer of tape compression. And also the bands that I'm kind of looking at, they didn't have the option of using digital at the end. So again, that's all part of their sound.
Yeah.
So I felt that kind of captures that a little bit more closely.
Yeah. So what's your method of getting that from that reel-to-reel into the digital world?
Well, at that point, obviously it has to go digital, and I pretty much just come straight out and try to keep the level. don't know, 3-4 dB below kind of clipping and just go for like a clean, simple signal.
Yeah.
So I don't usually put any effects in between that. I'll just kind of come straight off. And then if it's been mastered in the box, I'll kind of save that for later on. But I'm looking down here because this is where my audio interfaces are. I haven't really got anything particularly flash. It's just kind of Focusrite stuff, really. So I've got a 2-channel one and an 8-channel one,
yeah,
which tends to do a reasonable job.
So you just what are you using, Logic, did you say earlier?
Yeah, so Logic Pro, yeah.
Yeah, so straight into Logic and then saved as a digital format, ready to go up onto streaming or wherever.
Yeah, so with the YouTube videos, I tend to not do much with it from there because it kind of keeps it, I suppose, a bit more like it would be in the room. Mm. But the track I've just put on Spotify, Caught in a Daydream, I did, do some kind of mastering kind of style effects with that one.
Yeah, yeah.
So a bit more kind of, multi-band compression and that kind of business.
Yeah. So where are you going next with the whole tape scene? What's your next project?
Well, I think I'm going to do another recreation type video next, so another kind of cover. So I've done a few ones. I'm going to do another English band. I won't ruin the surprise yet, but so I'm kind of working that at the moment. But after that, I've actually kind of pretty much sketched out a whole album. So with the magnetic machines. Yeah, with the own stuff, yeah. And again, it's sort of within that sort of 60s style, that kind of genre. So it's roughed out, but yeah, I've kind of got a reasonable plan where I'm going with that. So I want to record that using the same kind of techniques I've explored in the previous videos.
Yeah.
And pop that out there as well.
Are you planning on doing any other tape machines other than the 688?
Yeah, well, I've got a few actually. I mean, I've got a bit of a problem, you could say. I've got a whole kind of bank of them up here. So I've got like 488, 688. I've recently got a 1/2-inch reel to reel as well, which I'm going to try out on the next video.
Yeah, 8-track.
8-track, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think you said you had a Tascam. So I think this, I guess, is before that because it's a Teak. I think it's 80-8 or 8-80.
Yeah, well, I had the 4-track version of that.
Okay.
And then I moved up to the 8-track. But I don't know about tapes now. Are they expensive reel tapes? I mean, I've got some receipts from for reel-to-reel tape somewhere, which was Ampex tape at the time, from Studio Spares, it would have been.
I'd
have to dig it out because I can't remember how much they were. I'm going to guess about £20, maybe more back then.
Yeah.
What are they now? Reel to reel.
Well, that'd be a great price now. You can actually buy new 1/2-inch, so it's Record the Masters who sell that. I haven't actually got any of that, but what my tape tech said was actually he found Bass to be better.
Yeah.
So it's super hard to get though because everyone bought Ampex and it's all gone sticky now.
Yeah.
So I managed to track down, two rolls of it on eBay. And it's about £50, which is sort of all right for this day and age.
Yeah.
But it's just super hard to find.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you're going for a new reel, you're looking at about 110, 120 for the Record the Masters.
You get about 30 minutes or so?
Yeah, I think slightly less, because it's 15 inch per second. Mm. And it's obviously was it a 10.5-inch reel.
Yeah.
So you didn't get much, really.
No, well, it was an expensive game back then, wasn't it? I mean, it was expensive then, even at £20 a reel was quite... You got to be careful. You don't want to be wasting too much of it.
No.
When you're spending that. And, bands were not paying a lot of money to record, really. And when you're getting into those sort of tape machines, it was quite expensive just to maintain them, service them, and keep them going.
Did you used to record over your tapes as well, or did you...
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, at the level we were at, I didn't notice any real deterioration. Even with cassettes, I mean, when I was using 4-track and 8-track cassette, we'd use record over them all the time because you didn't have much choice, really. It was just, half the time, it was just, we need to record this now. What have we got lying around? Pick something up and go, we don't need that anymore. Wipe it, start again. And
fresh start.
I think it was probably TDK was probably one of our go-to. There was a cassette called...
I think I've got one. Oh, one here, TDK.
Yeah. How do you find getting hold of those pretty easy now?
They're not so bad. Obviously, they do make a kind of Type 2 new one, but it's not very good. But you tend to go on eBay and pay between £3 and £5 for like a basic one like that. You can pay more for like slightly older ones. But that's kind of all right, although they're getting rarer. But the reel-to-reel, the 1/2-inch is definitely a bit harder.
And like you say, having the machines looked after as well. I think I said to you, I've got... The Tascam, ooh, what's it called? It's an 8-track cassette, the Sync cassette. Is it the 238 Sync cassette?
Oh, yes. Yeah, nice machine. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which I did some lots of recording on back then, and then sold it. I've bought another one, which has got a problem. Trying to get that fixed is really difficult, you know, and
yeah,
I don't know. But quite a good machine, I found, in the day. Considering, you know, 8 tracks on a cassette. What's that, quarter inch? Is it quarter?
Yeah. No, it's an eighth of an inch, isn't it? It's even thinner. Yeah, yeah.
It's tiny. But it seemed to work. It was okay.
I know, it's crazy. Because again, as I mentioned earlier on, I think, I started off the 4-track at school, but it was a really, really cheap one. It sounded pretty rubbish.
Yeah.
So when I came back into this sort of stuff, like 2007, 2008, I was actually quite surprised because it sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people who maybe see my stuff and haven't really looked into it before kind of, I'm not saying my stuff's that good, but I think they're surprised by the quality of some of the recordings when a humble cassette tape doing it.
Yeah, I think I've still got recordings of when I, my first attempt at ever recording was at my Ghetto Blaster, which had a mic built into it. So I'd record guitar into that through the mic, and then I'd play back the cassette back through my stereo in my room, through the speakers, really loudly, and then play the guitar through my amp and record it all back into the mic of the Ghetto Blaster again. And the quality was just horrendous, but you know, I was just so excited to have sort of three or four overdubs. I thought, this is great, but I need a better machine.
Yeah, why do you do anything else?
I know, but I think I even tried to record with a microphone on two, you know, the original cassette players with the 4 or 5 buttons on the front, just a normal cassette player.
Like those shoebox type ones.
Yeah. And I tried to record onto there with a microphone in the headphones. So I was playing music through the headphones, trying to record it with a microphone into that, squashed into the headphones. It was just terrible. I mean, the things I tried.
Yeah, big fuzzy mess.
Yeah. But you learn lots of things, you know, what worked and what didn't work.
Well, I remember when I started playing guitar first of all, didn't necessarily sing particularly. So when I was trying to learn to sing and play the guitar, I did a similar thing. Like, it was a Ghetto Blaster, a little mic in there. And I'll just sing and play it back and go, that sounded rubbish. I'll try it again and do it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't trying to overdub, but it was super useful.
And I think you learn about levels. You don't realise, but you're learning all that time about levels. You know, you try it once and you think, well, hang on. I can hear the traffic outside, but I can't hear the guitar. What's going on? And you just keep tweaking it and playing with it until you sort of, you don't realise how much you are picking up, I think, at the time.
But yeah, a lot of trial and error.
Yeah, definitely. So I see you've got a mixer at the back there. Is that the mixer you're using?
Yeah, so this one here, yeah?
Yeah.
It's not a new one, but I picked it up recently, so it can go with the TIAC.
Yeah.
And it's just an Alan Heath. It's a mix wizard.
Yeah.
I've not actually used it very much so far, but I'll be getting going on that on the next project.
Yeah.
Seems pretty solid. I was looking for something a bit more, I know, vintage. It's actually quite hard to pick up an old mixer, you know, for a good price that actually works.
So it
seems quite nice, quite clean. It's got 16 channels, so I can have it like a split desk with, you know, half a monitoring, half a recording.
So
hopefully it'll be okay.
I think my original mixer was a Tascam, I think it's called an MM8 or 16 or something. It wasn't very big and it had some meters on it. I've got a picture of it somewhere, so I'll probably flag it up in the video just as
Oh, nice.
And a couple of other pictures, I think, of my little room with my studio master and my effects rack and my reel-to-reel.
Well, I'd like to see that.
There's a couple of images of that flying around, yeah. I'll dig those out because it does take you back a little bit, you know. And one of the guys came along once with, which was, again, a bit different for us. He had Cubase running on an Atari, and we did the same thing. We used the SMPTE code generator to run all of his backing track, if you like, that he'd recorded, programmed into this Atari to tape, or run it alongside the tape to record to DAT with him playing guitar as well. He was a great guitar player, actually, as well. They were doing reggae almost, you know, so quite bass heavy but good, really good.
So what were you running on the Atari then? Was that kind of sequencing the outboard machines, was it?
Yes, he brought his own bits of kit along, and he had he'd got some drum machine thing from somewhere that he was using, and he once you've got that MIDI thing going with something like an Atari, you can hook up any module, you know, Roland module or sometimes Yamaha drum module, and as long as your MIDI pattern is right, your MIDI program is right, it'll play any module you want, you know. I mean, I sort of guess that they do it a lot by MIDI now, don't they? Use MIDI to trigger all sorts of stuff now.
It's
just normal. But back then, to start running a lot of electronic stuff with the tape running at the same time and syncing it all up, it was a bit mind-boggling at first. I was thinking, how is this going to work? You know, this noise generator just was like a weird, horrible noise on the tape, but it was just there and everything synced to it.
It's quite clever, isn't it? I mean, I didn't do that back in the day because I was kind of a kid and couldn't afford all that stuff, but I've tried it recently just out of curiosity, really. And it's like magic when it locks in, isn't it? Yeah. It's like, it's like a noise, and then it kind of just pops up, and you go,
well, yeah, done. You can wind it back, wind it forward, stop and start anytime you want, and it just all clicks in straight away. I thought, this is mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's very clever. Now, well, I actually tried a thing with a recent video before the magnetic machine stuff, where I was trying to get Logic to sync with the tape recorder.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can get this bit of software, I think it's called Lockstep. And essentially that sends your, well, you send out your kind of tape sync code to tape recorder. Mm-hmm. But then you can make it sync with MTC with Logic.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took a bit of messing around. So essentially with no special gear, just your computer and this bit of free software, I got it all hooked up.
Yeah.
So I had the drums on Logic and, you know, mixing the vocals and guitars on tape recorder.
Yeah. I suppose what was more difficult then, thinking back, is that there was nowhere to find this information, really. The only way you knew all this stuff was by reading things like Sound on Sound and electronic music production magazines and all that sort of stuff that used to come out once a month. And you'd try and read up on it all and see, try and work out, well, how can I make the tape sync to the electronic, you know, digital? And you read about these SMPTE generators, and I was thinking, well, what is that? You know, do I need one? I'll go and get one. And you have to just go and get one. And figure out how it works. You couldn't Google it, could you?
No. We can go to a music shop and ask, but unless you're buying it from that music shop, they didn't care, did they?
No. And I don't know, they must have sold them, I guess. I mean, there were some big, sizable music shops in Midlands where I am, and all the stuff was in there. But, yeah, I think the first... And then when we first moved to digital, our first one was the Roland VS880, which was the kind of hard disk multi-track Roland recorder.
Oh, yeah, big mixer with a little LCD screen type thing.
Yeah. Worked well, actually. It was quite good.
And how many tracks was that?
Well, it was eight, but it had
It
had these virtual tracks. So you'd have eight virtual tracks for every track. So effectively, you could have you could record 64 tracks and then pick, you know, whichever ones you wanted out of the 64 that you'd recorded to produce a mix, and then you could bounce them down, you could do lots with it, but it never quite had that step of being able to link it to a computer very well.
No.
You know, when you want to start, there's a lot of multi-tracks at that time when they started going into digital that were great standalone, but if you want to start actually thinking, well, if I just get this on my big screen, that'd be great, but it never worked. They didn't seem to ever get to that point, you know. Even now, I've got a Tascam DP24, I think it is, you know, a relatively newish digital recorder and mixer, but the interface on it's horrible to use. You know, there's a whole forum of people who, you know, love these machines, and they are cool, but not easy. I don't like. It's not easy to use. I found the one 25 years ago, that the Roland, I found actually easier to use than the new.
Really?
The new one now, yeah.
So it's almost more convoluted and more submenus and diving and stuff to get where you need to be.
But I think you should get one and try it.
I don't want to now.
But you can borrow mine and you can see what you think. You can say, well, somebody's loaned me this, let's see what it's all about, you know, because there's lots of videos on them. But it'd be interesting to see how your approach to recording to tape works on a very similar looking recorder that is digital.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's the same kind of process. The sound will be very slightly different, I suppose, because you haven't got the tape compression. But I guess it's quite popular at the moment. It's a lot of people want it to be a bit more doorless, so they're not relying on the screen and how things look and, you know, more about how things sound and maybe performing a bit more.
Yeah, that seems to be quite I think there is definitely a move towards people wanting the tape sound, and that they like the attraction of the. It's got a nice image. It's quite, you know, the nice machines, the tactile and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, as you know yourself, the reality of doing a lot of recording to them is a lot different. It's quite time consuming.
It is. I mean, it takes you at least three or four times longer to get something together on a tape machine.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're kind of an absolute genius and you just play everything first note, first time. Yeah, it's tougher. And I suppose, I think we touched upon earlier on, they're often broken as well.
Yeah.
You know, with my video, I'm not banging on about how they're broken when I get them, but pretty much you buy them off eBay, they come, they don't quite work properly.
Yeah.
And then you've got to find someone to fix them, which is, you know, a big part of the battle.
Well, yeah, and things go wrong whilst you're actually doing recordings. You know, we've had many recordings where you start doing it all and then suddenly something happens, the tape screws up, there's some weird sound, something happens, you can't get rid of it. It's really start again.
Yeah, and it can be quite frustrating.
Yeah.
That actually reminds me, when I went back to doing tape stuff 2007, 2008, I'd got the whole band around. I had a garage studio at that time, so we all got a set up. We did a couple of good sessions, went well. And I can't remember what I did, but it isn't really stupid where I plugged the input into the output of the Tascam 688.
Yeah.
And it literally pretty much blew up. It was smoking.
Yeah,
So it ruined the whole thing. I just kind of got a feedback loop and, ruined.
Yeah.
So the band left like, oh, okay, right, well, thanks.
Yeah, well, of course. And also the favourite of that's a great take, but you didn't press record, you know. That happened a lot.
Yeah.
And then, like I say, punching in and out with the foot switch. I think it was a great idea. I mean, I didn't. I'd been doing it by hand for ages, but then I discovered the foot switch and I thought, man, this is a revelation, the foot switch.
Yeah. It's like a little sewing machine thing, isn't it? With a, you know, you have the bottom sewing machine.
It allows me to just get it bang on. But again, you know, you've got to be careful, haven't you? You punch in and you overwrite something that's already, you know, you're a bit too early and you start, especially if you're trying to, I mean, we used to punch into gaps in the, you know, so you'd have something playing or maybe vocal. And then you wanted to put a bit of lead guitar in or a few little licks or something. You think, wow, I can just squeeze it in that gap in that vocal, you know. But of course, you don't want to chop off any of the vocal. And then when it comes to a mix, you've then got to be careful because as the vocal tails off, you've then got this guitar coming in, which you don't want to be the same level. And it's
too long, quick.
Yeah, you're all over the fader. We've done many mixes with two of us with two hands, you know, riding sort of 20, you know, faders or whatever it is.
Well, you need it, don't you? Because unless you've got a very fancy mixer, there's no automation.
That's right.
And it's also, remember, it's almost like performing the mix because you have to remember, you know, at 2 minutes, 27 seconds, the lead guitar comes in too loud. And like you say, you've got to pop it down.
Yeah, yeah. And adding, pushing the effects in and out as you go through the track. You know, we'd have effect on all the time sometimes, but you've got to ride the fader in and out to bring it in as you want it. So.
Oh, completely, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that's kind of easier about the four track because... Well, not along the way, but you've done a lot of those kind of parts of the mix before you get to the final mix. I mean, when you're left with the four tracks, you might have, I don't know, 16 parts, and you haven't got many decisions left by that point. It's either good or it's not really. That's right. So, you know, back to the drawing board.
Yeah. So we talked about your next thing, which is the, in music terms, which is recording an album. So what are you doing as regards your own? I know you've got your YouTube channel or a couple of channels or whatever. How are you progressing those now? What's your intention with that?
With the channels themselves or more the music?
Yeah.
Well, so I've got the two channels, one which has been going for years and years, which is the We Happy Few. So that's, I think I started that 2008. And it's a bit of a mixture of things. I think I've got two different viewerships. One is definitely interested in the old tape gear and the kind of process of doing stuff.
Mm.
But the other half's really interested in like slide guitar, because you might tell from behind I'm kind of obsessed by guitars.
Yeah.
So I tend to release lots of kind of short videos of me just playing like bluesy kind of raw guitar bits. Mm. So I want to kind of try to bring those bits together if it's possible without alienating both sides of that kind of a section of people. But effectively, I'm going to keep doing the shorts and keep doing the recreation videos with that channel. With the Magnetic Machines, which is my new band, you might say, or new solo project, I want to make that more about the music, you know, with a bit of the tape gear kind of mixed in, but more of a vehicle for that. And, you know, exploring that 60s sound and see where that goes.
Yeah. So how are you getting on? I mean, we touch on most things with artists, especially your own music. How are you getting on in the world of music promotion, you know, navigating all the social media sites to get your own personal music out there? How are you getting on with that?
that's probably the hardest bit, to be honest. I mean, I've kind of managed to, well, not work out a formula, but I can often get a video to do, you know, to get seen by, I don't know, making it short enough or interesting enough potentially to, or getting the right tags on there. So that's okay. But the thing I find really tricky at the moment is, and I don't know if I want to do that much, but to get things to be listened to on Spotify. Mm-hmm. I've certainly not cracked that. So that's one that is an ongoing thing. Because essentially, I think the way it works is if your track doesn't get played massively in the first 2 or 3 hours, it just gets dumped off by Spotify and it gets into, you know, the Spotify graveyard, and you know, that's done.
Yeah.
So as an independent artist, that's a big challenge, I'd say, at the moment.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, but that gets discussed a lot on other forums that I'm part of, and I don't know if there's really an answer. I mean, it's just Spotify is just awash with millions and millions of artists, you know, and it's just so difficult to break through, and I don't know what the answer is really. Generally, probably money really gets you. You know, if you're prepared to throw enough time and money at it in one way or another, you will start to rise towards the surface, you know. But I speak to lots of people, lots of bands, who, and some of them have had, you know, hundreds of thousands of plays and done quite well in that respect. But they're not making any money, that's for sure, even at that level. No. And so, and who I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that. You know, I think if you want money, it's probably Bandcamp, but Bandcamp isn't Spotify.
No, I mean, Bandcamp, it is great. I mean, when I did my last album, well, actually, that album before, actually, I did a whole analog album where it didn't touch digital at all. So I made it on tape recorders, I bounced it to VCR, and then I released it as a cassette, mm-hmm. which sounds ridiculous in, I think it was 2023. Mm. But I only made 10 copies.
Yeah.
And through my YouTube channel, I sold those 10 copies, which I don't know, made me 60 quid.
Yeah.
But to make 60 quid on Spotify, you'd have to get 300,000 views.
Yeah. And I say this a lot to people. I say, do you know what? If you really want to, if you want half a dozen people who might be actually interested in music and possibly even make more money, just go and busk in the street for a morning in your local town, because you'll probably talk to more people who are interested in what you're doing, and you'll probably make more money than the for the same amount of time put into something like Spotify, you know.
Exactly, yeah. So I don't think Spotify's, you know, built for the independent artistry, like we said earlier on. So I think going forward, it does help certainly if you do a video like my last one, which was, you know, more about the style of the track I was recording it in, and just pop a link in there. People do go through and have a little look at it.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, with the next album, I'll probably do a physical release as well. You know, maybe sell 10, 20 copies.
Yeah.
And to see how it goes, I suppose, really. Yeah.
So is your intention band? Is your prime focus band, or is it YouTube and you know what you're doing there, or are you trying to split the two, or is it just keep doing both and see what happens?
I'm just juggling, really, yeah. Because I've got my main band as well, which is Really Happy Few, which I play the guitar mainly in.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do gigs and kind of play out around London and stuff, and do festivals and things. So that's a nice thing to do. So I'll keep doing that. The Magnetic Machines is more, you know, kind of me exploring sound and trying things out. But the YouTube, I've really enjoyed it over the last few years. It's just kind of, it's a nice little kind of way of creating a whole project, which is almost like a little capsule by itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Which then just pop out there and people engage with, which I guess is how you kind of found me on the internet, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I like, you know, I've got one coming out just in the next week or so, which is a guy I spoke to as an indie label, you know, because I wanted to understand what goes on in indie labels, you know, these small independent that haven't got any money really, but they're still trying to get artists onto their label and try and do something with it and how it works. I mean, lots of people I see discussions in other forums about, do I need a manager? Should I have a label? You know, or should I do it all myself? And there's pros and cons to all of it, really. Depends how much work you want to put into it. If the indie labels got a little bit of traction and got a bit of a network themselves, they can help you quite a lot.
Yeah, of course. I mean, contacts make a big difference, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think necessarily that can help you get into things like Spotify, but they're not going to get you, you know, a million. The guy said, if you want a million views on Spotify, a million plays on Spotify, that we're not the people to talk to. You know, that's not going to happen because you're only going to get that through the big corporates.
Yeah, there's a lot of promo that goes into that, I think. Yeah, which you can't do cheaply, I don't think.
Yeah, but it's certainly, there's a lot of artists I spoke to who are quite serious, and you know, they like what they do, and they're very passionate about what they do as well.
And with those artists, are they playing live a lot as well? Because that's obviously a big way of promoting
stuff. Some are, it's a bit of a mix, but some are pretty much bedroom artists. They just play, record it, release it. Others are out there doing it, quite a lot. So, but anyway, AD, it's been really cool. I really like talking about tape and stuff like that and old mixers and stuff. So maybe when you've progressed a little bit further and you do another project, we'll catch up again and see how it went.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Really good. So, and hopefully I'll touch base with you on some other stuff as well. But really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us and tell us all about your processes.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have a chat, Tim. Yeah, so thanks for getting in contact.
No worries. We'll catch up again soon.
Cool. All right.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
All right, cheers.